Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
For lawmakers in Washington to agree in the next 2 weeks on how to reform immigration. But after this weekend's protests around the country, he urged a civil and dignified debate in Congress because, the president said, the system for letting people into the country needs to be more rational, orderly, and secure.
America should not have to choose between being a welcoming society and being a lawful society. We can be both at the same time. And so to keep the promise of America, we must enforce the laws of America.
The president used the occasion of a swearing-in ceremony today of 30 new American citizens to once again push for a temporary guest worker program. But a key Senate committee has deadlocked on how to create one and whether it would become an amnesty for lawbreakers. And today is that committee's last day to produce a compromise. Well, joining us on the line is Jibby Martinez, correspondent for the Houston Chronicle in Washington. And Jibby, we understand the committee has made some headway, for instance, rejecting a proposal regarding humanitarian groups. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the House bill, which was passed in December, expanded the definition of anti-smuggling law and said that it would be illegal for anyone who gives aid to an illegal immigrant that they could be criminally liable. And so what the Senate Judiciary Committee has been doing this morning is basically removing that prohibition as it relates to humanitarian groups. You know, the House bill was widely interpreted as being an onerous burden and perhaps making criminals out of priests and social workers and humanitarians who help people, including illegal immigrants. And so what the committee did this morning was actually say that they will be removed of that liability for the humanitarian groups.
Right. The proposal that was rejected from Senator John Cornyn, a Republican of Texas, was to require these humanitarian groups, churches, and others to register with the Department of Homeland Security. That was rejected.
Yes, that was rejected. He was trying to make it a little bit more difficult and say that anyone who was going to be providing this assistance needed to be registered with the Department of Homeland Security. And some of the senators who opposed that were saying, look, you know, you're basically going to require a person who serves soup in a soup kitchen to have to register with DHS, and a lot of times these are volunteers. And so Cornyn's amendment was rejected, and in fact, humanitarian groups will not be facing this criminal liability under the amendment passed in the committee.
And this is just one of the many side debates. And as you write, even immigrant and church groups agree that some immigration reform is needed. But we hear talks that the Senate Judiciary Committee might be pulling an all-nighter on this, and they're on a deadline. Remind us of the deadline.
Well, what happened is that the Senate Judiciary Committee began working on this bill about 3 weeks before a weekly recess that they just finished. And just before they went out on recess, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist followed through on his threat to say that if they did not finish by the end of the day today, he would take a border enforcement only bill to the floor, and that would not include anything regarding guest workers or some of the, you know, visa allotment proposals that have been offered in a more comprehensive bill. So what Senator Spector is doing is trying to finish his committee's mark today, even if they have to work past midnight, he said, because he wants to make sure that the bill that goes to the Senate is a Judiciary Committee bill and not just one that's limited to border enforcement, as Senator Frist has proposed. Now, you know, Senator Frist has said that if Senator Spector can finish his bill today, he will substitute it and put it on.
I'm sorry, could you just repeat? He would substitute it what, Jibby? We just lost that line a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. He would substitute Senator Spector's committee bill on the floor if they can finish at the end of the day today.
No, and just give us a sense of how this is impacting politics in the minute we have. You write about a candidate for Congress in Iowa who campaigned recently in Laredo, Texas.
Yes, it's really interesting. You know, this bill has been bubbling just below the surface for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, in some areas of the country even longer than that. And what has happened is that the radio talk show hosts have really kicked it up. And last year when the Minutemen Project began in Arizona, that brought a more public profile to the issue. And one of the things that you're referring to, Brian Kennedy, a congressional Republican candidate from Iowa, who went to the border and had a photo op there. And he, you know, his
Jibby, we're losing your phone line again, but you make the point that they are traveling to the border to campaign for states that really are pretty far away from that. We'll probably see more of that as we go into the midterm elections. Jibby Martinez, a Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
A series of new studies paints a bleak picture for young black men and their ability to get a job. Last week, you remember, we spoke with Baltimore Sun columnist Dan Rodericks, whose experience confirmed some of the study's findings. Dan put his phone number in a column and told drug dealers to call him if they wanted to get a job. Over 1,000 have. Rodericks says the men seem to want jobs but don't know how to find them. Ron Mincy, a professor of social work at Columbia University, agrees that the jobs are not there. He says there are other cultural factors at play, though. Rob is editor of the book Black Males Left Behind. He's on the line. And, Ron, Dan Rodericks says many of these black young men are telling him the jobs their fathers worked in factories are no longer there. Is that what your research found?
Absolutely. In fact, we have a qualitative chapter in the book that interviews black men in Detroit, and they talk about the same issue, that they want to work. Even their vision of what a good job is one where they get dirty, a manufacturing job that had high wages and but good health care benefits, and where the notion of hard work sustains a certain vision of honor in the community. However, they understand that those jobs have disappeared from the American landscape, and they need much more education, they need transportation, and many of them, unfortunately, have criminal records. And these changes mean that they are essentially left out of the information age economy in which they now live.
But you also say that there are these low-skilled jobs that we don't see black men in. Why is that?
Well, those jobs require lots of customer contact. They require the ability sort of to work in teams. And many of them do have criminal records. And I think and those who don't have criminal records, they are often barred from employment because they live in the same neighborhood of many men that have been to prison, have come back.
Truly.
Employers don't do background checks, particularly the smaller employers where they often apply for jobs. As a result, if you're a young black male who has no more than a high school diploma and you live in a certain community where there are many ex-offenders, employers often just throw your resume in the trash.
Sort of a form of job redlining.
Exactly.
I want to go back. You mentioned that some of those low-skilled jobs that black men are not getting require customer care. Why would that matter?
I think we have a curious phenomenon going on in America and in the world. Black male youth culture is one of the biggest selling phenomena that we've experienced in this decade. Not only in the United States, but all over the world.
You mean their hip hop and their low slung pants?
The hip hop, the dress, the swagger. We celebrate those things every evening when we watch the NBA, when we listen to music, or when our children listen to music, and all of our children, by the way, black children, white children. Chinese children, and it's really amazing. However, that behavior, that deportment, may be off-putting in a setting where you're dealing with adults and where you're dealing with people who are not from the same subculture.
You want to watch them on TV, but you don't want them manning your counter at the store.
Exactly. You honor that aggression. You understand that that masculinity and that bravado. But when you're served at the counter, you may be intimidated by that.
That must be very confusing and offensive to young black kids.
That is precisely my point. And then you have to try to understand how someone, as they're coming through from 16 to 18 years old, their dream may be to be a player in the NBA. Their dream may be to be a rap star, and they adopt the dress, the style, all of that associated with it, and they come through with all that. But then when they go out to apply for a job, the sort of affect of their dream denies them access to the labor market. Mm-hmm. How do you help an 18-year-old understand that?
Well, and how do you change this problem? You write that black women are making gains even though black men are being left behind.
Exactly. We had a deliberate policy in the 1990s to increase work among welfare recipients and to reduce their dependence on welfare. And we also had an economy that totally cooperated with the effort. Part of that strategy involved lessons in workplace skills and cultural competence, but you were entitled to those services primarily because you were a single mother.
And the U.S. spent $30 billion on an earned income tax credit, which subsidized these workers by about $3,000 a year. It was an anti-poverty program.
Exactly. But if you're a man and you don't have custody of the children, and by the way, a quarter to 50% of these young men are fathers of children, and many of those children are on welfare, you're entitled to none of that. In fact, quite the opposite, because you don't have custody for those children, you're obligated to pay child support, and many of these men would pay 17 to 25% of their income in child support payments. Not that they shouldn't, but their incentives to go to work, in other words, we required and enabled young women to go to work, and as a consequence, since so many young black women are single mothers, their employment experiences benefited from an economy that needed less skilled workers in the 1990s and a set of policies designed to require and enable them to go to work. And I think we need a similar set of strategies for men.
Some incentives such as?
Such as something operating like the Earned Income Tax Credit for young men who have child support obligations. For example, in New York, Governor Pataki's office is working on a variant of the Earned Income Tax Credit that would say for a young man who has a child, if you pay your child support obligations and go to work, we will first help you get a job. If you have a child support order and you're behind in that order and you get caught up, we will top off your wages, supplement your income so that work is better than not working.
And as you've just said, to elaborate on it a little bit, if these young black men do get legitimate jobs, which are on the record, 17 to 25% of their earnings are taken away in child support payment, but then there's no incentive there. So they end up living on, cash economies. They just, work under the table.
Exactly. And I've noticed this, and anyone who travels around the country notice that young black men are just missing from the public space. You don't see them in department stores, in retail stores, in hotels, in many places where less skilled people work. And as a consequence, they end up often being a net drain to their families and their communities. However, they often are helping out the mothers in a variety of ways. I don't want to, go too far with this idea that they're not contributing in any way, but the question I ask myself is, what are the minimal standards of citizenship that we actually have for young black men? And I begin to answer that question by asking the same thing of women, that we asked of women. In the 1990s, we used the phrase that began this program, we want them to be mainstream. But I think that's not the goal that we maintain for women, because in fact, we have seen welfare rolls decline, but many of the women who were on welfare are now receiving their Earned Income Tax Credit, they're receiving child care subsidies, they're receiving Medicaid subsidies, food stamps, and the like. So the minimum standard of citizenship for them was that they work and attempt to support their children, and as a society, we said that we would help them do that. Well, so I asked myself, what is the minimum standard of citizenship for young men? Do we really mean we want them to be mainstreamed and self-sufficient, or do we mean we want them to work, we want them to support their children? It would be great if they didn't have so many children, especially those from the mothers to whom they were not married and they couldn't support. And we also don't want them to be criminals. But are we prepared to back that up with what are we prepared to do to help them achieve that goal? And I think we need to, again, visit our successes in the 1990s and ask ourselves, how can we get to the same place for young men?
That's Ron Mincy of Columbia University. Coming up, more with Professor Mincy, but we'll also hear from Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson, who says if the hip-hop culture is keeping people from hiring young blacks need to know when to get out of hip-hop. Stay with us. More coming up here and now. Black males left behind. He says a big part of the problem is education, and he advocates for programs like the now-defunct Baraka School that took young black middle school boys from Baltimore to Kenya where they could focus on their studies. But, Professor Mincy, some would call that segregation. You say it works?
In a number of cities around the country, including the Baraka School, but in Minnesota and elsewhere, communities created specialized schools for African-American boys. And they were intended to give these young men a sense of identity, a sense of pride in their culture, and also an alternative to the subcultural arrangements in their neighborhoods that honored different and negative kinds of behavior. Those schools essentially were not sustained because they ran into civil liberties problems. The questions were raised, why are these schools closed to girls? Why are these schools closed to other disadvantaged children? And do we want to recreate segregation? And our answer in the 1980s was no. I think that answer was wrong. What we're seeing is that black boys, first of all, their educational deficits begin to occur very, very early. They occur as early as the third grade, and Kwanja Kunjufu, who is an educational specialist who was working on this way back in the 1970s, pointed this out years ago, and most of us ignored what he said. However, it's very, very clear. Black boys begin to fall behind. As a consequence, they are left back, and they, when they get to 17, 18, 19 years old, far fewer of them are ready to apply to college or to be admitted to college. As a consequence, fewer get into college, fewer graduate from college, and so forth. So
why do they fall behind from third grade on?
They fall behind from third grade on in part because they are within an educational culture that demands respect, that demands calmness, sitting down, paying attention to the teacher, that honors and rewards academic achievement. But if you have a whole variety of other kinds of gifts that doesn't really provide rewards for you. I have two black sons. I raised them and did battle for my sons in school, trying to help teachers understand, is there a middle ground between who they are as boys, your demand, which is appropriate for respect, for authority, and their coming through and understanding, the boundaries of appropriate behavior.
So you're saying, Professor Mincy, that they need to have specialized, some would say segregated schooling. Do you worry, though, that opens up a Pandora's box of people saying, yeah, black boys are different. Racist claims that there's something genetically flawed in them.
Well, I think if we were talking about any other sorts of problems, if we were talking about medical problems, if we were talking about other sorts of issues, we would be willing to take some risks. And I think we've reached the point here where we had better take some risks as well.
Professor, another issue you touched on is that because many young black men don't have legitimate jobs, they don't have health care. How do you see that manifested where you live in Harlem?
I see it manifested because, I see a lot of men who are under 30 years old who've been injured somewhere or other. They're in canes. They may have been shot. They're in canes. They're in wheelchairs. They don't have their teeth are in disrepair. They may have been in prison where they didn't have adequate health care, or not in prison. They don't have eyeglasses. They can't see well. It really is in the nature of a human tragedy. We could be seeing the beginning of a different kind of crisis, and that is, for those who survive into their 50s, what will be the state of their health?
Who will pay for it?
Who's going to pay for it? Because they have been disconnected from their families, who is going to care for them? In my mind, I've been working in this area for almost 25 years, half my adult life. We have just gone too long and too far not attending to this problem.
Ron Mincy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Professor Mincy teaches sociology at Columbia University. We wanted to check in briefly with Orlando Patterson. He's a professor of sociology at Harvard University, and he agrees with Professor Mincy on many things, including that there's an historic socioeconomic issue that undermines young black men. But when it comes to hip-hop culture, Professor Patterson says it's a factor because blacks don't know when to quit. And Professor Patterson, you say sociologists have a name for this culture. What is it?
Well, a couple of sociologists called it the cool pose culture, and I think it captures exactly the kind of swagger and the extreme sort of the gratifying nature of this culture. It's important to understand that the kids get a lot out of it.
Cool pose culture, you write in an op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday, it's, as you said, too gratifying to give up, almost like a drug, this hanging out on the street corners, buying certain clothing, owning the hip-hop culture, you know, the music that everyone's listening to. And you also cite studies that say it not only makes young black men feel good about themselves, it gives them better self-esteem than whites?
Yeah, black women in particular, but also black men, young black men, have the highest self-esteem of all groups, and that's independent of how badly they're doing.
Well, then why should they give it up?
Well, that's a good question. White kids are heavily into hip-hop, too, but they know when to shift gears, so to speak, and start preparing for their SATs. And the problem is you have the culture being used as a substitute for success rather than as an additional thing which you can do.
So it becomes a substitute for any other kind of success, and they don't know when to get out of it. And you write that that's what we have to study, how to get them out of it. Where would you start?
I don't necessarily want them want to get out of it, I want them to, number one, be able to shift, to voice the task culturally, if you like, to how do we get to the point where the involvement, the engagement with the street culture doesn't become an all-consuming passion and so generative of self-esteem that they feel that they don't want to do the other things necessary.
Professor, where do you start? Where would that shift start?
It begins with providing them with after-school programs, because the street culture begins from very early for boys. Boys find a male role model and some model of masculinity. So on the streets, and this begins from very early. And if you have longer school days and a well-funded after-school programs which will offer alternate attractions within which school can segue into that, that clearly will be one way of cutting into it.
Orlando Patterson, a professor of sociology at Harvard University. Fascinating conversation. Thanks for participating with us.
Thank you.
We've just begun to scratch the surface. We also spoke with Columbia University professor Ron Mincy. His book is called Black Males Left Behind. Well, stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The meetings of Israeli police and soldiers are fanning out to prevent violence during tomorrow's national elections. Final polls show support for the centrist Kadima Party slipping, raising the possibility that a coalition government could include more hardliners. Thanasi Kambanis is covering the Israeli elections for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Jerusalem. And Thanasi, there are security concerns, but Israelis are used to those. Does this feel different to you?
The actual mood on the streets here is felt pretty calm and fairly apathetic. We've seen the reports of the increased security presence, and we've been seeing flashes of dozens of terror alerts every day this week. But in terms of how it actually feels out there on the streets, it's been pretty quiet. There haven't been any successful terror attacks in several weeks here in Israel, and I think people are less concerned about the security on election day as they are about the political ramifications of what's going to happen.
Well, let's talk about those. The polls today, we understand, show acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's lead slipping just a bit. Is this a reflection of the Hamas-led Palestinian government, which is getting into shape this week as well?
Hamas has postponed announcing its government until today and probably approving it tomorrow. And that's seen, in a sense, as an effort to help calm things in Israel. If they had seated a Hamas government in the last 2 weeks, I think it would have helped the hardliners who say that Kadima and Olmert are too soft on Hamas. By doing it on the same day as election, it sort of mutes the impact on the Israeli vote. Now, Israel has been anxious ever since the end of January when Hamas won those elections, and I don't think Olmert's slippage in the last few weeks has anything to do with Hamas, but it has more to do with people getting to know Kadima, which is a brand new party, and really each week that it's been in existence, its support has eroded.
Let's remind ourselves, Kadima, the centrist party founded by Ariel Sharon, before he fell into a coma, he's still lingering in the coma. So tell us more about, you know, what a Kadima platform calls for. We understand the unilateral definition of Israel's borders without consulting the Palestinians, and the final border in place by 2010. So what are the thoughts on that?
What you just described is pretty much the centerpiece and the most clearly defined aspect of Kadima's platform. For the rest, it's to carry on Sharon's legacy, and that is not something that's clearly defined. By contrast, you have the Labor Party, which is the second most popular, and their platform is your standard sort of social justice, improving conditions for workers, improving unemployment, and they've been fairly quiet on security issues, more or less ceding that to Kadima, saying whatever the center has decided to do to protect Israel from the Palestinians, we're on board with. From the right, we have Likud, Ariel Sharon's old party, and they are calling for no unilateral actions vis-a-vis the Palestinians because they say giving up land without getting secure promises from the Palestinians for better behavior is tantamount to rewarding terrorism. So they say maybe Israel should withdraw from the West Bank, but not until the Palestinians have promised a ceasefire, recognized Israel, and a whole host of other conditions. A third element, which hasn't been written about too much, is the growing popularity of an even further right party. There are two right-wing parties that now each have more than 10 seats, according to the polls, One is the traditional religious right, SHAS, National Religious Party, Religious Union, which are parties we've seen over the last few decades. A second party is a Russian party called Israel Is Our Home, which has some echoes of ultra-nationalism on political issues like the Palestinian question, and is fairly progressive on social issues inside Israel. That right-wing bloc has swelled in the last few weeks, and it looks in the polls like it's going to get maybe as many as 30 or more seats.
Well, the polls also say swing voters might make the difference. They make up about 10%. So how are these different candidates and these different parties that you just mentioned, how are they appealing to these swing voters?
Well, it's funny because the centrist Kadima Party and Labor have been running in a sort of unofficial coalition because they've worked together in the last government and they're expected to work together in the next one. Suddenly, though, in the last few days, they've started attacking each other really vigorously. That's because their internal polling has suggested that the undecided are choosing between those two parties. So suddenly they see 28 seats up for grabs that they can get by fighting each other. At the same time, the other thing we've seen is the right has sent volunteers out blanketing the country, knocking on people's doors, saying, we don't care which right-wing party you vote for, just vote right-wing in order to stop this withdrawal that's in the cards from the West Bank.
You talk about the interest in this being and what it says about the future of Israel. Can you just detail what some of those choices are? I mean, what might some of the different wins mean?
Well, the main thing up for grabs is how and whether Israel will withdraw from the West Bank. Now, since Israel left the Gaza Strip this summer, it's been accepted as a sort of foregone conclusion, although I'm not so sure it's going to go so smoothly, that Israel will leave the vast majority of the West Bank, something like 80 or 90% of the territory there. Now, that's the big and easy summary of what's expected to happen. How will that happen could be any number of ways. Will they take away most of the settlements? Will they leave the big settlement blocks in there, enraging the Palestinians and just building a wall or fence around them to keep them as part of Israel? Will they decide to negotiate with the Palestinian Authority president? Will they find a way to talk to Hamas and do this withdrawal as part of some kind of framework of a peace agreement, or even as part of the U.S.-sponsored roadmap? Or will they simply do it as a unilateral necessary security move? That and the future of the settlements is really what is at stake for Israelis.
Well, interesting, because that seems like a lot. That means that there's a lot at stake, and we're reading that the 5 million or so eligible voters in Israel are, bored by all this. You used the word apathetic. Make that connect for us.
The way I'm trying to understand this is that voters feel like the results of the election, as far as how many seats each party will get, are a done deal. And so all these huge questions are going to be determined in negotiations over how a government is formed and who gets what ministries.
Thanasi Kambanis is covering the Israeli elections for the Boston Globe. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. One last quick question. Is there any chance that apathy might lead to an upset, might lead to, let's say, one of those far-right factions that you mentioned kind of sneaking in and taking more seats or actually even winning?
I think that what might be unexpected is how much strength the right-wing parties are going to have, especially because it appears that Kadima is going to rely on at least one, the Russian-based party Israel Is Our Home that I mentioned earlier, to be a coalition partner. I think their influence is going to be larger than people expect now, and I also think that the lesson of Hamas's victory should hang heavily in the air. No one thought Hamas would win. Hamas won big. Here we have an election in which the pollsters say more than 10% of the votes, they don't know how they'll go. To me, that's a big red flag to say, I'm not so sure how this will turn out. And we know from history in Israel that a swing of 5 or 10 seats either way can make the difference between a government having to tilt to the right or tilt to the left.
Thanasi, thanks so much.
It's good to be with you, Robin.
Thanasi Kambanis in Jerusalem will, of course, cover the elections there tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. That's the sound of deliriously happy George Mason University fans. In one of the biggest upsets in men's college basketball, previously unheralded George Mason beat top-ranked Connecticut in the regional finals to make it to this weekend's Final Four in Indianapolis. In fact, no 11th in its region seeded team has made it to the Final Four since Louisville did it in 1986. Big deal in basketball. And joining us on the line from Fairfax, Virginia, is George Mason alumni and booster Brian Dunbar. Brian, how much sleep did you get?
Only about 4 hours.
You got that many? I'm shocked. Well, you were at the game at the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C., which is kind of like home court for George Mason. And here you go into a two-point win in overtime. What were those last few minutes like?
Extremely exciting and nerve-wracking. I don't know if my heart can handle another situation like that.
When did it dawn on you that, hey, we might actually win this thing?
Well, we got, we got about a five-point lead there with about three or so minutes to go. And I won't say I was getting relieved, but I was actually like, wow, you know, we could actually do this.
And to put it in perspective for people who aren't following this, yours is a team, George Mason's in a team, is a team that until this year had never won a game in the NCAA tournament.
Exactly. This is our first at-large bid. We unfortunately didn't win our tournament, so if we hadn't gotten an at-large bid, we wouldn't have even been in the tournament.
In fact, yours is one of the teams that a lot of people griped shouldn't even have been in at all.
Yes, and I won't even mention the names of the people who have said those things.
Well, now your team, George Mason, is going to meet Florida this Saturday in Indianapolis, which means you're also going to meet Joakim Noah. Now, he's the son of tennis great Yannick Noah, and his mom was a Miss Sweden. He's been out there playing air guitar and astonishing people with his play. So what are you thinking going into that game with Florida?
Oh, I definitely think we need to figure out a way to control him, but I think our team's strengths are that any one of our players can step up. In a way, I like when we go up against a team that has, one major star, because, if we can take him out of the game, then we can kind of control the game.
And Brian Dunbar, just let me ask you, as an alumni of a school that suddenly is, finding itself heading for the Final Four, does that really do anything for you as a George Mason alumni? I mean, what does it do to your school and the fact that you went there?
Well, I think the great thing is the media exposure we're getting. We are a great school. We've been a little overshadowed since there are so many great schools in our area and in our state. Even though it's our basketball team getting the recognition, the name George Mason will be known now, and maybe people will actually take a look at us in all respects.
And maybe the alumni office is gearing up for perhaps a few more contributions.
Yes, I would hope so. That can only help us to become an even better university.
Well, so here you are, and it's one of many Cinderella stories, but maybe the biggest one, and so now you've got to wait till Saturday. And people are talking about how the NCAAs are impacting, the amount of productivity in this country this week. How are you feeling? I mean, how are you going to get through till Saturday?
Oh, it's definitely a huge distraction from work, but I guess it's a welcome distraction as the distractions go. So I couldn't ask for much more in that regard.
Are you going to go on Saturday?
Most definitely. I even made my plane reservations before the game, just to make sure I had the reservations and got my hotel reservations and just working on tickets at the moment.
Well, while you're looking for tickets, you might also want to brush up on some of the many theme songs the team is acquiring. One of them, we understand the coach mentioned going into a game. Which one is that?
It's Kryptonite. It's a rap song, and he made a comment before the UNC game about UNC fans thinking their team was Superman, and he stated that we're Kryptonites. And we went out and proved it. So that's kind of become our one of our de facto theme songs here.
Right. And at the end of the game, we understand the band played Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer, which I'm sure there will be many of them over the next few days.
Most definitely. That's a song they've played at almost every game for us this year. So kind of a great sentiment to our tournament so far.
Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Of course, we're rooting for everybody. Brian Dunbar, an alumni of George Mason University. Teams never won an NCAA tournament game till this year. Now they're on the way to the Final Four. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. enticed her, and the NYPD launched the largest ever manhunt at the time to find her. Celia Cooney was a Brooklyn laundress turned bandit who became a lightning rod for the social issues of the 1920s. Shirking the law and the corset, she was the bobbed-haired flapper, a wanted fugitive who pulled off a series of stick-ups, but was herself held up by politicians and pundits as a victim. Well, her story is now told in the book The Bob-Haired Bandit, a true story of crime and celebrity in 1920s New York. And authors Stephen Duncombe and Andrew Mattson are here to tell it. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Steve, set the scene for us. New York, 1924, crime out of control, a post-World War I wave of consumers wanting to have it all, but really the wages don't match those expectations.
Yeah, and really that's kind of the setting that's so important for understanding Celia Cooney, is that there's sort of a mismatch between expectations in the 20s. Remember, the 20s, as we remember them today, is the roaring 20s, champagne pouring, the world of F. Scott Fitzgerald. But the reality for most people in the 1920s was hard work and relatively low wages. Yet there was also expectations of the good life in department store windows, on the silver screen, and in ads, and with the introduction of credit. And to a certain extent, Celia Cooney gets caught up in that. She and her husband are poor, working class, they're going to have a baby, and Celia wants a better life than she had. She wants to give her child a nice apartment. She wants to give her a nice crib. She wants to get a dinette set. But there's no way they can afford it on their wages.
So she decides to take up a gun and take up holdups. And tell us, why, Andy, was Celia Cooney such a big newspaper story?
She arrived at a time when people were really concerned about the modern girl, about the modern woman. The women were voting, women were driving fast cars, women were working, women were going to dance halls and not obeying their parents. And she was a young woman with a gun and bobbed hair, and the bobbed hair was emblematic of the modern girl.
Who knew bobbed hair would be so important? But as you write, this is at a time when there are a lot of questions about women. Should they sit on a jury, run a business? Could they smoke a cigarette, bob their hair without permission from a father or husband? And here she was, bobbing away.
The fact that she had a gun and that she had a car and a sealskin coat became accessories that were talked about. And in the articles about her, they talked incessantly about the way she dressed and what she said and her fashions. And they always interviewed the women victims of the robberies with an eye towards what she was wearing that day. And the fact that she was fashionable, the fact that she was aggressive, the fact that she was a boss over men really symbolized for a lot of people the problems with women these days.
Well, plus she really worked hard at it. I mean, we think of the Roxy Hart character in Bob Fosse's Chicago. You know, she loved those flashbulbs. She sort of adjust her makeup and her hair.
She really did. I mean, she really liked the idea of being a celebrity. Part of the good life of the 1920s was not just about material. It was also about being seen, being recognized. Photoplay. It comes out in 1910. This is the heyday of Hollywood's sort of idea of the movie star, and so being recognized and being seen really is part of the dream for her, and she really acts up for it.
She understood the role of the bandit. She was a regular reader of weekly papers for women and for men, True Detective. She liked the police news. She liked the Argosy All Story Weekly. And these were full of stories about women going wrong, essentially good girls who were either seduced into a life of crime or were forced into a life of crime by circumstance. So when it came time for her to play the bandit, she was following a script to a certain extent. It was all around her in the movies and the magazines. And when the newspapers interviewed her, she knew exactly what part to play.
Well, Celia Cooney and her husband Ed, sort of who played second fiddle to her, were finally caught in Florida after a botched payroll stick-up. They came back to a crowd of thousands awaiting them, and William Randolph Hearst paid her $1,000 for her story. And you write that this book is really about how that story was manipulated by the press.
Well, it was like all stories used by the press. It was used to tell stories. It was used to make points. It was used in a battle over culture and politics and so on and so forth by not only the newspapers but politicians, social workers, and what have you. And what we really tried to get across in our story is that Celia Cooney really becomes a mythic figure. At one time, the mayor of New York City, Mayor John Hyland, says there is no bobbed-haired bandit. She's really just a myth. And in many ways, he's correct. She really is a myth. She becomes what people want her to become.
Well, Celia Cooney did find the straight and narrow after serving 7 years in prison. And ironically, she and her husband find the American dream, a house in the suburbs, but because they went to prison.
Yes, Ed loses his hand in a stamping machine making license plates when he went upriver. And after his hand is cut off, he gets blood poisoning and is forced to undergo several successive amputations. But when they're paroled in 1931, their lawyers file a suit against New York State because of the amputation, claiming that the stamping machine didn't have any safeguards on it. And they get a $12,000 judgment, which they split with the lawyers, which is the down payment on that American dream. And they buy a small house in the suburbs, which they lose not too long afterwards in the midst of the Depression. Mm. But what really saves them in the end is World War II. Ed dies tragically of tuberculosis, leaving Celia alone with their two very small children. The war comes along, and she becomes a war worker at Sperry on Long Island. And that's what lifts her into the successful working class.
Well, and in fact, even those two little sons, as they grow up, don't know about her past. She's forgotten. Her past is forgotten. She's not in the headlines anymore. And then as she grows older, she gets Alzheimer's and unburdens her story to them. Is that possible? They didn't even know?
Yeah, well, one of the conditions of her parole was actually that she couldn't tell her story. That one of the things that the prison authorities were very concerned about is that she would glamorize the story of her life of crime. But she also just didn't tell her sons because she wanted to live the life on the straight and narrow. And it's late in her life. She starts to develop Alzheimer's. And part of the symptoms of her Alzheimer's is that she runs away from the nursing home, heading for New York. The police pick her up. And she turns to her son and says, "Don't let them get me. They know who I am. They know I'm the bobbed-haired bandit." Mm. Of course, the son says, "The bobbed-haired who?" Forgets about him, Ely.
Because she thinks she has dementia or Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's dementia, exactly. He's never heard of anything like this. It's only after she dies that he actually goes to the library and starts to discover who his mother really is.
Wow. And how do they feel now? I mean, you know, here she is.
They had a couple of years to deal with the story of their mother, and I think it was difficult for them. And they were very cooperative with us, and they were frankly impressed that we were so interested in their mother and that we were providing them with reams of newsprint and photos about their mother. And the fact that we grew to love their mother, not so much because she was a bandit, but because she was very much a character and she had a forceful will. And as one of the sons said, describing his own mother, she was a tough old broad.
Stephen Duncombe and Andrew Mattson, their book is The Bobbed Hair Bandit, A True Story of Crime and Celebrity in 1920s New York. For more on the book, by the way, including some of the terrific pictures, go to here-now.org. Steve, Andy, I smell movie.
Well, we'd love to smell it, too.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again all this week here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Does the